So hi everyone and welcome to yet another episode of the Foss North Pod. Today we have Javier from CERN joining us and talking a bit about open hardware and open silicon and so on. So Javier, do you want to say a few words about yourself?
Yes, so thank you for the invitation. My name is Javier Serrano. I'm Spanish. I started working at CERN in 1998. And currently, I'm leading a section of hardware developers and low-level software developers as well. And we do accelerator controls, so control systems for particle accelerators.
Wow. So should we start off with, open hardware is a new thing. I guess for most people, it still is for me, although I've known it for a couple of years. So can you please say what open hardware is?
Yes, I guess the easiest is to go to the definition, which is currently, I think, the most widely accepted definition for open hardware is the one maintained by the Open Source Hardware Association. And it's a longish definition inspired by the open source definition, actually. But the first sentence, I think, quite sums it up, which is open source hardware is hardware whose design is made publicly available so that anyone can study, modify, distribute, make, and sell the design or hardware based on that design. So this last bit is what sets it apart as well from the open source, standard open source software.
And I think it also pinpoints where the main difference is, since software is intangible, while you with open hardware actually end up with physical goods. It's differences in how the whole market works, basically, since you actually have to implement something to have it distributed.
Definitely. There are tricky bits about it, and there are good things about it, but definitely that's the key difference. And that's where sometimes we would like to capitalize as much as possible on free and open source software, because it is something that's proven to work, and it has many successes. Whenever we come across issues where we cannot apply directly the teachings of free and open source software, it is because of that, exactly what you said, which is market, economic considerations, all related to the fact that hardware is tangible, yes, as opposed to software.
Okay, so when and perhaps even how did the open hardware thing start?
I think a gathering of momentum towards the last few years of the first decade of this century, so 2008, 2009, where many people start, I think, realizing that it was becoming easier and easier to develop hardware. And I think that's also kind of what happened. That's my interpretation of what happened with software as well. Software becomes more widely spread and more accessible to people in terms of development in the 90s. And then it becomes really a big concern to guarantee that it can be shared efficiently and without any legal hurdles. And then there's all this movement put in place to, for example, make sure that people have the tools to do it appropriately, et cetera. Because the loss for society, if they didn't put this thing in place, would be quite big, because there were so many people capable all of a sudden of developing software. And something similar happened in hardware, but later. Okay, so it became with the arrival of Arduino and with the arrival of good open source tools to design printed circuit boards, and later on even more with the 3D printers and all the mechanical CAD software. All these enabled people to do things, even for hobbyists. Hobbyists are now capable of designing things that would have taken a small company a few years ago to do. So with that democratization of access to hardware design, came the realization that we needed to put in place infrastructure to share appropriately, and of course following on the footsteps of the software world, which was, you know, had solved most of the important issues already.
So when it comes to open hardware, I mean, we have a spectrum of devices, all the way from like laying out PCBs and putting physical components in there, where I guess we have quite a lot of open source tooling, and then we have this gray zone passing through CPLDs and ASICs through FPGAs until we're really, really soft at the end. But when it comes to software or the corresponding technology to compilers, so basically software for implementing these, would you say that the full spectrum is covered, or are there weak spots and blank spots?
No. For example, we're having a discussion right now in our group at CERN, because we want to start doing what the software people have been doing for many years, which is continuous integration for HCL design. And it would be so nice if every time we modified something, it went through a whole set of tests. And in our case, instead of a compiler, we need to use something called a synthesizer, a synthesis tool to generate the hardware, and also a simulator. A simulator is a piece of software that will take your HCL code and then some other HCL code, which is not your design, but something that's like stimuli, and it will apply them, and it will seek what comes out, and it will hopefully say that everything's all right. And for HCL, we use a number of languages. We use VHDL, Verilog, System Verilog, and mixed language simulators. So simulators which can take a design made of many blocks in different languages. There's no good open source product to do that. There's no project that does that. There's a very good VHDL simulator. There are good Verilog simulators, but there's no simulator that will take sources from many different languages and run them together. So that's a big problem for us, because we want to do continuous integration, but that means that every time we run our tests, we're going to be taking one of the expensive licenses from the pool of licenses at CERN. So if everybody does this and we don't coordinate the times that we do this, we might actually run out of licenses. So it is a big concern. And I think it's probably among the set of issues that needed a solution back when we started in the more than 10 years ago. That's probably the one that remains the biggest hurdle to sharing today. It's the lack of appropriate tools, software tools, which are free and open source for the type of things we do in hardware.
You mentioned earlier that, I can't remember exactly, but that the open hardware definition was sort of inspired by the open source definition or free software definition.
Yes.
So how similar do you think the movements are?
Very, very similar. The end goal is the same. The end goal is to guarantee a number of freedoms or make sure that sharing can be done efficiently, depending on how you look at it. I don't look at these things as contradicting each other, but complementing each other. So it is exactly the same ethos and the same key idea behind, except it is applied to hardware designs instead of software. So when you try to transpose that world of free software to the hardware realm, you come across a number of issues. And in fact, that was my journey, actually. That's the way I started doing this. In our team, we have two sub-teams. One is a team of hardware developers, and the other one is a team of Linux kernel hackers. And the whole idea was, you know, looking at how the Linux people worked, their daily experience, you know, could we get that for the hardware people? That's, you know, how easy it was for them to interact with the outside world, to tap into the big knowledge base outside, to collaborate with other labs and companies without falling into a vendor lock-in situation. All these good things, we wanted to have them for hardware as well. So to answer your question, I think the end goal is exactly the same, or at least that's how I came to this. I mean, that's my angle.
Cool. And the communities, so do you have like the rivalry between open source and free software?
No, I think there were some talks many years back, because there were a number of initiatives at roughly the same time. And luckily, that didn't go further than just some people drawing parallelisms between those different communities and the free software versus open source controversy in software. That didn't go very far. I think everybody agrees these days that you know, the open source definition is a reference for people doing open source hardware. I don't think there is this rivalry or this controversy. So I think we're very lucky that it didn't take. It didn't, yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Would you say that you relate to other movements that have come more recently? Like you have this right to repair movement and so on?
Oh, of course. Yes, definitely.
Is this the same people, or is this a parallel group that then share the same goals, basically?
Yeah. I think everybody is scratching their own itch, and then some people come to open hardware from that angle of right to repair, and some people come through other experiences. But definitely, there's a relationship between because in the sense that if you want to have the right to repair, then having repairing something which is open source is much easier.
Do you see an adoption of open licenses when it comes to reference designs, when it comes to hardware? I mean, I'm a layman in this. I'm more of a software guy. But so if mm-hmm. I design hardware, I usually copy basically the application notes.
Yes.
And I would assume that they would benefit from coming under something like a permissive open license. That would be the software way to do it, to provide an example.
Yes. It must be said that the legal status of those diagrams is something that historically was not fully clear. I think people assumed, and rightfully so, because when a big silicon vendor provides example schematics, their goal is for you to use them, of course. So I don't think people ask themselves the question of whether they can use them or not, because obviously the intent of the vendor is that you can use them. Okay, so it would be ridiculous that the vendor sues you for copyright infringement because you used their example. But now, the fact that good licenses didn't exist. So there was no point in asking the question, should this be licensed under this or that license to make it rock solid from a legal point of view. Now that good licenses exist for that kind of work, for schematics, for example, and layout, I think it would be a good idea to explicitly say what it is that you're expecting people to do or to be able to do with your schematics. Yeah.
I guess you can come to some interesting scenarios, even with examples. So perhaps building an example out of other people's examples and mixing components from vendors who are competing and things like this, where mm-hmm. you're sort of, where it would be nice to have clarity.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's the
overflowing for hardware, you mean?
Yeah. How do I drive an engine?
Yeah, and that's exactly the goal of the licensing effort that we have been carrying out in at CERN, is to bring clarity. Exactly, because it could look like a complicated document the first time you read it, but things are complicated sometimes, and sometimes you need a license which is not trivial to express what you want. But once you have studied it and it has been scrutinized by many people and accepted, then it becomes a zero effort way of making sure that your design is shared as you intended. And it is, yeah, one of the main objectives we had when we drafted, especially the latest version, version 2 of the CERN Open Hardware License, was clarity, how to make sure that people understand exactly what we intend.
it's a bit similar to how people reason about the GPL. It's very long and complicated, but it's long and complicated for a reason.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And of course, GPL was a big source of inspiration for us. In the beginning, the CERN Open Hardware License was I would say a strongly reciprocal license, because at the time also the default license for software at CERN was GPL, and it still is. And then with time, we realized that different projects had different needs. And one of the big things we've done in version 2 of the license is to split in 3 variants so that people can have a permissive license if they want, or a weakly reciprocal one, or a strongly reciprocal one.
Do you address things like patents and such in the license as well? I mean, that's something that came with GPL v3, but I assume, and software patents is still not widely accepted.
Yes.
But I guess for hardware, it's
of course problem. It's not an option. In hardware, talking about patents is not an option. It's the elephant in the room. So, of course, we have, in the beginning, we had this patent license that we had from very early on, in which you say, okay, I'm publishing these schematics, and I give you the right to copy them, to use them, or whatever. And then also I give you the right to use any of the patents that I hold that you would need to make use of these schematics, okay? Because of course it would be ridiculous that I give you something and then I sue you for using it, you know. So I'm reassuring you that I will not sue you for patent infringement in this particular design, okay? Then something that I, you know, immediately after we published version 1.2, I thought that I wanted to have this from another license, which is like the precursor, which is the Tapper license, which had a complementary clause in which I'm a licensor and I'm publishing this design and you use it, but then if you sue me for patent infringement, you lose also your rights for this design. So it's kind of the complementary clause. And that we added in version 2. So it's 2 ways. And the aim, of course, is as the creator of the Tapper license wanted in the beginning, when he came up with the original Tapper license, is to have this ever expanding area of patent free designs, a guarantee that you will not be sued for patent infringement if you're in that kind of ecosystem.
Do you have these organizations like the Open Invention Network that exists around Linux, for instance, where you basically create a patent pool between members?
I don't know the details. For example, of the there are a number of organizations about RISC-V, for example, and I don't know if they do that kind of thing of pooling patents. I don't know. They may do so because there are some big players in there, and that's typically what they do. But I don't have details.
Yeah.
Can I just ask you? You mentioned that there are 3 variants of the open hardware license. Mm-hmm. That there is a permissive one, a strong reciprocal one, and a weak reciprocal one.
Yes.
How does? I mean, I'm trying to think what would constitute linking.
Yes.
In a weak reciprocal license. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes, of course. And this is, of course, where we had to work hard to come up with new concepts. In the 2 reciprocal variants, the strong one and the weak one, we needed to make it clear where the obligations stop. For feeding back improvements, for example. So with our colleague, Andrew Katz, who's a lawyer specialized in open source and open hardware in particular, he came up with this notion of available component and the notion of product. So when you have a design going down when you start zooming in, okay, your obligations stop at available component. And an available component could be something like a resistor. If you design something and put a resistor there, we're not requiring that you publish the recipe to make a resistor out of carbon and metal and things like that. Okay, so it is not, but it is important. It is important because, you know, a naive reading of some of the reciprocal software licenses would leave you with a doubt of whether you need to do that. Okay,
you would basically have to be like a physicist to build all.
Yes, yes. So it was very, very important.
Forge the metal as well.
Exactly. Yeah. It was very important to establish limits going down, and then going up as well. We have the notion of product, which is what you make out of the sources, and that's a product. Okay, so if I design a mouse, a computer mouse, and then I make the product, which is the mouse, which is clearly defined because that's what I make out of the design, okay? Then if I connect it to a PC, that PC is beyond the product, okay? So I don't need to publish the schematics of the PC just because I connected the mouse to the PC, okay? So from that point of view, with those notions, those two notions, available component and product, I think we pretty much manage to make it clear what should be shared and not shared in each given variant of the license. Then, okay, there are also complications, especially when you get to the HDL realm. HDL is very tricky for reasons which were mentioned earlier. It behaves as software sometimes, and it behaves as hardware sometimes. You can, for the same sources, they can take different paths. And if you simulate them, you're actually running software in your computer. You're running them as software. But if you make a chip out of it, this is something that, you know, the reference definition we have for hardware is something that you can drop on your foot. So it is, a chip is hardware. And then it becomes legal, from a legal perspective, something different. For these, and then to complicate things even more, the tools in ASIC design are historically quite proprietary. And also to complicate things even further, part of those tools are primitives and bits of software and gateware, which end up being part of your design as well. And they are also very proprietarily licensed historically. So excluding those bits from the reciprocal obligations is key if you want to make these licenses usable, even the strongly reciprocal one. You know, you need to exclude those bits because otherwise it's completely unrealistic to expect, at least today, that people design chips in which even the primitives, even the silicon primitives, are open source. And that will probably change in the future, but there are some efforts underway for that. But today, you know, if we want people to be able to use a strongly reciprocal variant of the license for chip design, there's some things that we need to cater for. And there was an effort in version 2 of the license for that. Yes.
Maybe we should do a quick just recap around that. So an HDL, a hardware definition language, is used to define the behavior of hardware. And then, as you say there, Javier, you can run it in a simulator, which means that it's interpreted as software, basically. And I think I recall that was how it all started, with the DARPA organization wanting to be able to specify silicon through an HDL and not necessarily implement it or synthesize it from it. But then the other problem is, and it's decades since I did this, is that you have a softer kind of hardware, like an FPGA, which is programmed by a bit file. I'm not sure if you can break out a part of a bit file and sort of replace it on the fly. I think you need to synthesize the whole thing each time, which means that dynamic linking is basically impossible, and it's hard to sort of create object files and provide them to fulfill these LGPL license-like things. But you could also take this HDL and then bring it into an ASIC, so actually creating your own dedicated silicon. There is nothing soft left about it. And as you say there, you get a gate library from the ASIC vendor basically telling you how their gates and gate combinations look. And that's sort of the building blocks that your synthesizing tool implements your HDL description using. So you can apply this from everywhere to a piece of sand to pure software, and it's the same source code. Just a quick recap for all our software devs out there.
Yes, definitely. That's a good summary. We write HDL, and then we run it through a tool called Synthesis Tool, which is the equivalent or the analogous of a compiler. And this tool uses primitives which are available for example, in an FPGA, which is something that many people use these days. Field Programmable Gate Array has primitives. And the Synthesis Tool is going to interpret what you wanted in your the behavior you wanted as you expressed it in your HCL. And it will then use the primitives to create a circuit that behaves, that fulfills the behavior that you specified in your HCL. Yes, that's correct. And in the case of the FPGAs, that ends up being a bit stream that you load on the chip from flash or remotely. And in the case of ASICs, it becomes a piece of silicon. So this really, the fact that we can take these two routes, and the fact that the tools are historically very, very proprietary, and we cannot benefit as the free software world from free compilers and free editors, etc., at least not to such a large extent, that really complicates the licensing. So, yes, that was a challenge.
Would you say that it makes sense to create open tools here? Because to some extent, I guess the primitives and the actual optimizations or heuristics of the algorithms are specific to the physical properties of, for instance, an FPGA. That somewhere there's a boundary where you go from generic software to something that's very specific to hardware design.
Yeah, but I don't see that much of a difference with the world of software, in the sense that an ARM processor and an Intel processor and a RISC-V processor also have different internal architectures and different instruction sets. And the silicon vendors have disclosed enough information for people to write compilers. Could we have something similar from the FPGA world? That would be really nice. So they disclosed enough information for people to write synthesis tools and place and route tools. It would be great. There are some heroic efforts of reverse engineering these days, and some are quite spectacular. But it would be really nice if they could just get the information they need from the vendor, and I think I have the suspicion that if one vendor did that, they it could also be a competitive advantage for them. It would be the vendor that gives you all these details, so maybe they could get more business out of it. I don't know. I'm not well positioned to say what they would lose. But so what are the reasons why they don't do it today? I don't know. But I can imagine that there would be a lot of people using a new FPGA family if it had reasonable performance. And in addition to that, it was open from an architecture point of view, so that the tools could be open source.
Yeah, and I imagine that a lot of the investment that they make these days is in the tooling. So if you can share that maintenance and that development,
yes, that
would probably help.
Yes, exactly. The same way that, again, in analogy with the processors, the same way why that the big processor vendors allow people to make compilers for those processors and benefit from those, many brains thinking about how to optimize code and so on, and they end up making money out of the silicon and not of the software. I could see that that should be able to work as well in the FPGA world.
Yep. I'm a bit curious. We mentioned a couple of minutes ago, or like a minute ago, the software again, and I'm thinking if I'm listening to this, And actually, I'm like asking for myself. So how do I begin? Is it possible for me to begin today with open hardware? And like, what do I get? How do I do things? Mm-hmm. Is there a startup guide?
Yes. It depends. It's a bit like in software, in the sense that you need to have like a domain, something that you want to do, right? There's no startup guide to starting in free and open source software. But if you like, for example, to design music software, then you join people who have a similar interest, and then you will have all the tools you need to write the software. You will choose a language, you will get a number of tools to help you, editors, compilers, debuggers, and so on, and then you will start collaborating with your colleagues. The same thing for hardware. I mean, you can have an interest in developing printed circuit boards, or designing 3D printable objects, or going into gateware, you know, and buying a development kit for one of the FPGA from one of the FPGA vendors, and starting to write HDL and synthesizing and generating a bitstream that you can use. So yes, the answer is you can start, but there's no general recipe that I know of. It really depends on what you want to do.
So I figure it's kind of easier. You just apt get install GCC and you can start developing, or yes, another language if you
yeah,
get that.
Yeah. So it depends. Again, if you want to do a printed circuit board, for example, at CERN we are big fans of KiCad, which is this PCB design tool that we are contributing to. And we are trying to get the drawing office, that means the people doing layout for CERN designers 8 hours a day, to provide KiCad support in addition to the proprietary tools that they are already using. So if your goal is to do a little PCB, for example, an add-on board for your Arduino or something like that, then it's very, very simple to get it done with KiCad. And then there are other free tools as well. And apt-get will also get you KiCad, yes.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Cool. So at CERN, and I think you run it, am I right? The open hardware repository.
Yes, yes.
Can you describe it?
It's well, today it's nothing special. It used to be something that we judged necessary when we started, which is a place on the web to share hardware designs. Okay. Now, of course, nowadays it's easy. If you want to share something, you upload it to one of these very famous Git-based places, and you're good to go. There's nothing keeping you from sharing. When we started the Open Hardware Repository, I think it was 2007, 2008. It was not so simple. Plus, also, we wanted to have a place where we could grow a community around, like the people with an interest in our case, it's controls and data acquisition systems for big physics facilities, okay, telescopes, cosmic ray detectors, neutrino detectors, particle accelerators. So these are the people we meet at conferences, and they have similar interests to ours. So these are the people we could potentially share our designs with. Because, of course, there's no point in putting a design out there if nobody can use it or nobody has an interest in using it. So the other part of the equation for us is this community with people with similar interests. So today, the Open Hardware Repository is nothing else than a GitLab instance, GitLab Community Edition. It's a convenient place to share designs. It has version management. It has a wiki. It has we attach a discourse instance so that people can discuss in forums. So every project has an attached discourse forum. So it's nothing special by today's standards. What makes it special for us is that we know many people working there, and we share many interesting designs with them.
Okay, so for me, I'm a huge fan of what CERN does. I'm super interested in physics and basically whatever you do down there. So I'm interested in what is a normal, or A, is there a normal day? And if there is a normal day, how does that look like for you?
Uh-huh. I don't think there's a normal day. There could be a normal week, okay, in the sense that, you know, we do a number of things. I, for example, do a number of things, and some days I do more management, some days I do more technical stuff. So the perfect week for me is made of a bit of everything, a bit of, of course, technical work is the main activity. So in our case, designing electronics to control particle accelerators, and in particular, we have a big interest in synchronization systems. So how to make sure that if you have two pieces of electronics which are distant with respect to one another by several kilometers, that they share a common notion of time, okay, that they know at the same instant, they think the time is the same to within typically one nanosecond, so one billionth of a second. So that's our big specialty. So on a typical week, I would discuss with my colleagues. Nowadays, I do less and less design, but I still try to, you know, keep contact with either through design reviews or informal discussions to try to understand what's going on and to try to drive it in some kind of way. There would also be management these days. So in my particular case, my main goal is to make sure my colleagues are not overloaded, which is our biggest problem. So too many interesting projects. And in the end, we can have a problem if we take on too many things at the same time. So I have a keen interest these days in reducing the workload. And that's, I think, the main service I'm giving to my colleagues is trying to take care of them, make sure they have labs and all the gear they need and so on, but also enough time to do things right. And then there would be, in a perfect week, there would be also a bit of outreach, like what I'm doing now with you guys, or discussing with people outside, which is also part of the mission at CERN, to talk with people, explain what we do. There's also education. So I'm an official CERN guide. That means that, you know, there are groups of students coming, not now with COVID. Yes, and I tour CERN with them, and I enjoy very much, for example, teaching them physics through hands-on experiments, doing a cloud chamber to detect cosmic rays and things like that. So there would be a bit of that, but yes, the main activity is technical. In our typical week is a lot of electronics and software.
Cool. So where do I sign up for the
Go to jobs.web.cern.ch. Everything's explained there. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. For quite a few years, you've been publishing so much, not only hardware, but also software. So it seems as if you've been doing public money, public code before the concept arrived.
Yes. And this is where the founding fathers... unfortunately, I cannot say fathers and mothers. It was only fathers at the time. The founding fathers of CERN, they were extremely visionary, actually. They signed something called the CERN Convention in the 50s, in 1953. And if you read this document today, it is a very refreshing read, actually, extremely modern. I would say more modern than the founding documents on many, many more recent institutions. So one of the things it says is that in Article 2, the purposes, is that the organization shall have no concern with work for military requirements, which was a big thing, of course, after the World War. If you put the words nuclear and military in the same sentence, it was a big no-no, of course. But then he continues to say that the results of its experimental and theoretical work shall be published or otherwise made generally available. And then later on, it says that this can include cooperation with outside laboratories, and this cooperation may include, in particular, the dissemination of information. Now, if you read this in the technological scene of the 21st century, many of us interpret that this means open source, that open source is a very, very efficient way of fulfilling this part of our mission. So there are different people at CERN with different interests. You have software developers, and for them, free and open source software is one way of doing this. There are people dealing with data, and they use open data. There are people doing publications, scientific publications, and CERN plays a big role in open access as well. And for us hardware designers, open hardware is a very, very natural way to fulfill that mandate.
Has any useful software come out of CERN? I'm kidding.
Aside from HTTP, you mean?
Yeah. Okay, cool.
But it's actually kind of fun because we've had, well, three speakers, if counting this one, in FOSNORTH scenarios. So one of the very first speakers we had, which unfortunately is not recorded, was Alessandro Rubini, who worked exactly on this keeping time in Linux systems.
Yes, of course. I worked a lot with Alessandro, and I have the fondest memories of those times, and I have a lot of respect for him, technically and non-technically.
that was a very appreciated talk, actually. Good fun. He showed us how to keep your own lab equipment. You put a big sticker on it that says broken, then you get
very
to keep it.
Very original thinker as well. Yes, Alessandro. Yes.
A question about Alessandro. Did he take the bike down to CERN?
I have not seen him bike at CERN, but I'm sure he would enjoy the tunnel because, you know, in the tunnel is 27 kilometers long, and there are only eight shafts. The I'm talking about the tunnel for the LHC, the largest accelerator. So it's 27 kilometers long, and there are only eight shafts to go down. So very often you need to walk quite a long time, and there are bikes that people use actually to go to places in the tunnel. Yes.
Excellent.
Yeah, that actually takes us to our second speaker. So we had Stephen Goldfarb, I think his last name is. I forget. Who actually worked on the Atlas project?
I see. I know him from his music group.
He plays jazz, doesn't he?
Yes. Yeah, I've been in performances. Very, very good player. Actually, singer. He's a singer. Yeah.
No, so you produce a lot of good contents for us as well.
Yes. Greatly appreciate it. It's a great place. Great place with lots of interesting people. That's one of the big things. One of the things that I like most about CERN, people.
What has been the funniest or craziest the craziest experience you've had at CERN?
I don't know. There's a fair number of funny moments you have. For example, I remember a crazy physicist running naked in the CERN relay race. You know, there's this relay race every year. I mean, not now with COVID, but there used to be this yearly relay race, and there was this guy running naked. But more closely to our work, I remember with the White Rabbit development. White Rabbit is this synchronization network that we designed with Alessandro and many other people. The beginning of the design overlapped in time, or as the design was reaching maturity, we had this neutrino time of flight anomaly, which is, I don't know if you guys remember from the news, but there was this claim from the OPERA collaboration in the Gran Sasso National Laboratory that neutrinos seem to be traveling faster than the speed of light in vacuum. Which of course would be against relativity, and it would be a big thing, of course. So we were asked by the director of physics at CERN to move faster through the completion of the White Rabbit project to try to deploy it in parallel with the other data acquisition systems in Gran Sasso in Italy to see if with that redundancy we could identify any problem in the data acquisition system. Okay, so to install this timing system in parallel, and one day he wanted us to give a demo to him. This is somebody who was very high in management. You know, director of physics is like the second highest person at CERN after the director general, but in the past he had designed timing electronics, so he was very keen on understanding how our gear could make sure that two distant locations agreed within a nanosecond in terms of current time. And so we go and do this demo, and one of my colleagues, Tom, who was the main designer of the White Rabbit switch, starts doing what we call the hot air gun demo, which is, you know, you take a roll of fiber and you want to mimic long distance. So you take a roll of fiber, which is 5 kilometers of fiber in a single roll, and you have it on the top of the table, and you can connect two switches with this roll, and they are as if they were distant with respect to one another for 5 kilometers. And then what we do is we turn on White Rabbit, which is this feedback to evaluate the delay in the fibers. And we see that the two pulse per second outputs align perfectly on the oscilloscope. And then we switch it off and we heat the fiber with a hot air gun. And then the fiber, so the starts expanding, but also its refractive index starts to change. So the delay changes because of these two reasons. Actually, the refractive index is a bigger effect than the expansion. So you start seeing the drift of the two pulse per second outputs, and then you are supposed to switch White Rabbit on again, and they align again because the White Rabbit mechanism measures in real time this delay and corrects for it. Okay. So my colleague is actually explaining this is quite a solemn occasion, you know, this is the director of physics. So everybody is very concentrated and we want to get things right. And we're looking at the projector at the screen and explaining things to him. And my colleague is kind of very gently moving his arm, trying to not focus the heat on the fiber for too long on the same spot. But then at some point he gets carried away with the explanation and he forgets to move. And then he starts actually to burn the fiber. So you have these people, you know, very concentrated on trying to make sure the director of physics understands all these intricate design. But at the same time, the director of physics actually trying to tell us that the whole thing was burning. So it was, yeah, kind of a funny moment. Yeah.
That's when you don't ask, have you tried turning it off and on again? You just ask, is it definitely not burned?
Yes.
I think let's cut this piece, the thing I say now. So, but should we close off with, do we have any more questions or do you have anything you want to add, Javier?
Let's see. No, I think I'm fine. Yes.
Cool. So we can do this afterward. But these founding papers would be great to link.
Yes, it's called the CERN convention. So if you Google for CERN convention, you should easily find it. I can actually, let's see, I can, in fact, you know, I took these comments from a presentation that our director general gave to in EPFL, which is the university in Lausanne, and I can give you a link to that presentation because she extracted, let's see if there's a chat here I can use.
Let me just get an ending while you look for that. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So with those words, okay. I think it's...
Sorry. Let's start. 3, 2.
So that's a good point to stop at. So with those words, a big thanks to you, Javier, for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you. A great pleasure.
And you can always find the pod at foss-north.se/pod. We will put our show notes there with links from what we've talked about and so on. And yeah. See you around.